This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. An unusual collection of scientists, engineers, fishermen, and government regulators gathered in Woods Hole recently to discuss an even more unusual idea. Fishing, and specifically catching lobsters, without stringing ropes between the seafloor and the ocean's surface. The workshop was motivated by the dire status of North Atlantic right whales. There are fewer than 450 of the whales left, and that number is falling rapidly. Entanglement in fishing gear is a leading cause of death, and may also be impairing those whales' abilities to have babies. But is fishing without ropes a feasible solution? Mark Baumgartner is an associate scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and he heads up the North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Heather. Glad to be here.
Just quickly to recap where these whales are at this point. I mean, estimated fewer than 450, and we've had 19 documented deaths in the past year and a little bit, 18 in 2017 and one already this year that was an entanglement. These ship strikes and entanglements are the leading causes of death. Those aren't new activities. Why have we seen such an uptick in the rates of death of these animals in the past couple of years?
So the rates of death from ship strikes have actually been going down for a number of years because of federal regulations about how fast ships can go along the East Coast during times when right whales are present. But the rate of lethal entanglements has gone up precipitously over the last eight or so years. We don't completely understand why, but it likely has its roots in two things. One, when the cod fishing industry collapsed, a lot of guys turned over to lobster fishing. So there is more effort in lobster fishing than there were, say, in the mid-1990s. That is not true in all places, but in many places, effort has gone up. Also, ropes have been getting stronger since the mid-1990s. There are new technologies available to increase the strength of rope. They used to get entangled, but they could break free of the entanglement. Today, the size of the ropes and the strength of the ropes suggests that they get into these entanglements and they can't get out anymore. And then those entanglements get very complicated and the animals ultimately die from the entanglement.
And even if they don't die, there's evidence at this point that that stress of being entangled long term and in some cases being underfed and dragging extra weight along as they swim, all of that takes its toll and may actually be affecting the birth rate of the species as well.
That's right. Just imagine walking around with a 300-pound pack on your back. You're probably going to lose weight pretty fast if you're walking around with that all the time. That's when an entangled female whale is any whale is experiencing when they're dragging all this gear with them. They just are using a lot more energy to swim through the water. They usually can't feed as well. They're dealing with infections. So their body's really working hard, but they lose fat. Now, for females that lose fat, if the entanglement doesn't kill them, if they get out of that entanglement, either by humans disentangling them or by them somehow getting free of the gear, it takes them a long time to get back into shape in order to be able to carry a pregnancy and wean a calf. And so entanglements not only cause mortalities, but they're also delaying reproduction for these females and driving the calving rates down.
North Atlantic right whales, the ones that are around here, are one of three species of right whales. The southern right whales and the North Pacific right whales seem to be doing a lot better than the North Atlantic right whales. Larger populations, more stable populations. Do we understand what the differences are?
Certainly southern right whales are doing very well. They, like North Atlantic right whales, went through a period of whaling. Once whaling was banned, they've been coming back really strongly. The difference between southern right whales and North Atlantic right whales is really us. Where southern right whales live, mostly the Southern Ocean, there's not a lot of human activities there. There's not a lot of shipping. There's not a lot of fishing activity, particularly fixed fishing like lobster and crab fishing. But in the North Atlantic, in the western North Atlantic, where North Atlantic right whales live, there's a lot of that activity. And so the vast majority of troubles that right whales are facing, North Atlantic right whales are facing, are from us that their southern cousins don't have to experience.
And it's actually not just North Atlantic right whales. There are now three large baleen whale species, also humpback whales and minke whales, that in this same area along the east coast of the United States have been experiencing much higher than usual death rates over the past couple of years, in large part due to human activities, either ship strikes or entanglements. So clearly we've got a problem here in terms of whales and human activity along our coastline.
Entanglements are not just about right whales. Humpback whales, fin whales, sei whales, minke whales all experience entanglements, as do leatherback turtles, which is an endangered species that visit our waters too.
I'm talking with Mark Baumgartner. He's an associate scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and he heads up the North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium. Let's talk about this workshop recently, Ropeless Fishing Workshop. Really interesting mix of scientists who study the whales, engineers who could potentially design new fishing technologies, fishermen who would potentially be putting them into play, regulators who would be overseeing that, and also nonprofit environmental advocates. One of the first agenda items was to try to discuss the need for new fishing techniques and the need to address this situation with whales and entanglement. I mean, with a group like that, can you even get agreement on that need?
Surprisingly, yes. If this workshop had happened a year ago, I would say no. Two things have happened in the last year. There was a tremendous die-off of right whales that were directly linked to human activities, ship strikes and fishing gear entanglements. In 2017, there were 17 whales found dead. That, coupled with the fact that our colleagues at the NOAA Northeast Fisheries Science Center here in Woods Hole published a paper that documented the decline of North Atlantic right whales. So you had a paper that came out to say right whales are in trouble, and then you had the sort of tangible evidence of having bodies on the beach, as it were, to demonstrate that problem. That has changed the conversation around right whales significantly from one where there was a lot of doubting about the data to one where now people accept that there's a problem and it needs to be addressed. And we're moving on to, okay, how are we going to address that problem?
So what would ropeless fishing look like? I mean, I think that's a really hard concept to even try to imagine. We've been fishing with ropes and nets this way for hundreds of years.
That's right. So this would be a big change. This is a big ask of the fishing industry. Let me talk for just a second about the promise of ropeless. What we mean when we talk about ropeless is no what are called end lines. So if you go to sea and you see a lobster, you see lobster traps, what you see is a buoy at the surface. And then there's a rope that goes from that buoy down to the first trap. And then there's a number of traps that are connected by rope on the seafloor. And then there might be another rope going up to the surface and another buoy. So what we're talking about when we talk about ropeless is removing those end lines, the ones that connect the buoy to the trap. So the promise of ropeless is that if you remove those lines, you're likely going to eliminate the vast majority of entanglements.
So those ropes that are laying on the bottom between the row of traps, you know, stringing one trap to another along the bottom, those aren't nearly as much of a problem.
They're not as much of a problem now. So there's been federal regulations as well as in the state of Massachusetts regulations to make those are called ground lines, to make those ground lines actually lay on the sea floor. They used to be floating up in the water column. There was a lot of concern and even a paper in the mid-2000s that implicated those types of ropes in entanglements. But since sinking ground lines have come into regulation, ground lines have been much less implicated in entanglements. Now, floating ground lines are still used in coastal main waters where it's very rocky and very difficult to fish without them, and they're used in Canadian waters as well. But with sinking ground lines, we think that the risk of entanglement is much reduced. And now we see a lot of end lines showing up on animals in entanglements.
Besides being, as you say, a big ask, a big shift potentially in the workflow of fishermen and a cost for replacement and all of that, there's just a technical challenge here. I mean, how do you actually do this? How do you actually get rid of the line that goes from one end of a string of lobster pots up to the surface.
So there's actually three technical challenges that we talk about when we talk about ropeless. Remember, that buoy and that line were there for a very specific reason. The buoy's there so that the fisherman can find his gear, grab onto the end line, and actually pull all of the gear back. So there's a retrieval mechanism that we need to replace if we go ropeless. But that buoy is there not only so the fishermen can see, but other fishermen and other mariners can see where the gear is. The gear could be that another fisherman comes along, and if that buoy's not there, he'll lay his gear right over top your gear. Or if I'm fishing for scallops, say, for instance, and your lobster gear is in front of me, if I don't see your buoys, I don't know your gear is there. And so I'll drag my nets right through your lobster gear and destroy all of your gear. That's called gear conflict. So the technical challenges that we need to address are some sort of mechanism to get the traps from the seafloor to the sea surface, some way to trigger that process. And the third is about that gear conflict, marking the gear in such a way that other fishermen and other mariners can, quote, in quotes, see the gear without actually having buoys at the surface. For the first technical challenge, getting the gear from the seafloor to the sea surface, we have a couple of things. One is to have a spool of rope or even a bag of rope that sits at the seafloor. And when the fisherman wants to get their gear back, they send an acoustic signal, a particular sound to a device on the seafloor that's attached to that spool. And that device detects that sound and says, oh, the fisherman wants the gear back. I'm going to let go of this bag or spool. And that spool rises to the surface and it unspools an end line. And so the fisherman now can just pick up the spool, pick up the end line, and pull his gear on board. So
just he would have before.
Exactly like he would have before.
It was held at the bottom until it was needed.
Exactly. It's an end line on demand instead of always being available. The second technology is really quite exciting. It's low cost and it's elegant and it's simple. And it's been used many, many times before in the salvage industry. If you want to raise a car from the bottom of a lake or a plane from the bottom of the sea, what the salvage industry does is they send down a giant or many deflated plastic bags, and it's attached to a tank of compressed air, just like a scuba diver would use. And when it gets to when they attach it to whatever they want to lift, all they do is transfer air from the air tank to the bag. That inflates the bag. It makes it into a big float on top of this. And there's amazing lifting power in those inflated plastic bags. And they'll actually lift whatever you want off the seafloor. The real challenge is the gear conflict issue. Is how do you mark the gear? How do you replace the function of those buoys so that other fishermen can see? And so what we've proposed is to use technology to acoustically mark the gear. What if we had a device on the trap that could communicate information to a device on a ship? So if the information that you're transferring from the trap has something about its position, then the ship at the surface would know exactly where the trap was. So imagine I've laid down some gear, you're a scalloper, you're coming towards my gear, your modem talks to the trap's modem, and the trap's modem says to you, here's my position. That position shows up on your navigation screen, and you say, whoop, there's some gear in front of me, I'm going to steam around it. It's as simple as that. It's not a complicated or kind of crazy Star Wars technology. It's technology that we have available to us, and we use all the time in the oceanographic industry, research community, all the time. Let's just apply this to commercial fishing.
My guest is Mark Baumgartner of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and the North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium. You seem very certain that this is where we are headed in terms of fishing technology. That certainly didn't seem to be the case even a few years ago. Has there been that much of a shift? Do you really think this is inevitably where fishing is headed?
So I'm very optimistic about the technology, obviously, because I'm a person who uses this kind of technology all the time. And I see it as something that's simple and natural for us to use to address this very important and critical problem. The situation that right whales find themselves in is extremely precarious. There's only 100 breeding females left in this population. And so we are kind of on a countdown now to the extinction of the species. And as scientists, we've sort of calculated out that the species probably has about 20 years at the rates that we're killing them now, they have about 20 years. So what's going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years is as the population continues to decrease, there's going to be more and more of a call from the public for the government to do something about this problem. Fishermen have, the government and the fishermen and conservationists have been talking about this problem for a long time, and they've tried a number of different things. Some things have helped, but none of them have solved the problem. So if this, if we keep going on this trajectory, and there's no reason to think we won't keep going on it if we don't do something, right whales will get, it'll get worse and worse for right whales, and the calls for the government to do something will get louder and louder. Now, the government only has so many options on the table. It's reduced breaking strength rope, it's ropeless fishing, and it's closures. Closures, if we take the first two off the table, all that's left is closures. And I tend to think that closures are likely inevitable, that we can't just wait for right whales to go extinct and then we can fish all we want with ropes. The public is very in tune with animal welfare issues, and the seeing a right whale die from an entanglement is a really horrible thing. It takes months for it to happen. It's a gruesome way to die. And if it happened in a, if it ever happened in a land animal, the public would not tolerate it. But this is happening at sea. So as we go along, I think it's just going to get harder and harder on the industry. And once that happens, I think the conversation is going to stop. We're not going to be talking about solutions anymore. We're going to be yelling at each other. And that's, and so we have to do something about this problem now before we get to a place where we just can't have a dialogue about it anymore. And that time is now. There are challenges. One of the main challenges is affordability. So I've just talked about a lot of great technology, right? But it costs money to do this. Who's gonna pay for that? These are all questions that we need to be addressing over time, either through government subsidies, trying to encourage commercial production and competition amongst companies to drive prices down. There are lots of things that have to fall into place for this to work.
You mentioned the public pressure, and we're already seeing that mount in the form of a lawsuit against the government saying, you know, you're not doing enough to protect this endangered species. So the pressure is definitely mounting, as you say. And the third and final kind of agenda point for this recent gathering was to kind of chart that path forward. You know what the possible technologies are that, that you have on the table. You know what the obstacles are. So what are the paths forward? What needs to happen and what is happening to try to make this a reality?
So there's definitely a technical development path. We need to take the technology from the sort of the prototypes where it is now. We need to, the next step is once the prototypes have been sort of tested and the engineers are confident that it said the technology works the way they want it to, then we have to get the technology into fishermen's hands. Not to fish with, not to, I'm not talking about a wholesale introduction of this technology into the industry. This technology can't be used tomorrow for the industry. This is not going to be available widely in the industry for many years. But what we need to do is put the technology into the hands of fishermen and see, is this going to work for them? Is this operationally feasible? Can they actually use it? And, you know, fishermen are amazingly resourceful and amazingly clever. And if they get something that's not going to work for them, they're going to tell you how to fix it. And once they get it to a point where it's workable for them, they're going to figure out how it works best for them. That's just the nature of their work. Once we're done with that, I think an experimental fishery. Take an area, close it off to, or use areas that are closed off now to fishing, like Cape Cod Bay, the Massachusetts Exclusion Zone, and use ropeless fishing there. Take 10, 15, 20 fishermen and have them actually use the gear operationally. There's lots of other things that need to go on. We need to be doing economic studies about the conversion from roped fishing to ropeless fishing. What kind of government subsidies are required for this? How is it going to change the fishery? These are all questions that just require research that's going to happen over the next couple of years.
Given that you've already said this species is on a really tight timeline, do we have that kind of time? I mean, if it's going to take years to roll out this new technology, a new way of fishing, by the time we've got it in widespread use, is it going to be too late for North Atlantic right whales?
It will be if ropeless is the only tool in the bag. The other tool that we have in the bag is reduced breaking strength rope. As I mentioned earlier, rope strengths have increased since the mid-1990s. The rope that's being used today, even the same diameter rope, so a lot of inshore fisheries guys use 3/8-inch rope, even that rope is stronger now than it was. So the ropes you're using today were not your dad's ropes. So all we're asking, or one of the proposals on the table, is just turn the clock back. Let's go back to the mid-1990s and use rope strengths that were used then. That will, it won't reduce the number of entanglements, but it'll reduce the lethality or how many whales are killed by the entanglements. And we see that as a pretty, again, it's still a big ask for the industry to change over to those reduced breaking strength ropes. But we see it as a practical interim step before ropeless comes online. And we would see this as a kind of a rolling way to roll this in. Fishermen are changing out their ropes all the time. And so when they change their ropes, just ask them to use this reduced breaking strength rope.
That's Mark Baumgartner. He's an associate scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and head of the North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium. Mark, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, what if forensic science isn't scientific after all? That's coming up after the break. Stay with us.